Blog Talk Radio.
Of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. I'm here in San Francisco, California, attending the Singularity Summit, and I'm exhausted, but having a heck of a time.
You know, I think that facility where you're at, isn't that the same place the Singularity Summit was last year?
Maybe I wasn't at the summit last year, so it's possible.
Okay.
All right.
It looked familiar. I've seen the landmarks around there from the pictures and the where they're advertising and everything.
I can tell you the last time I went, we were at the Exploratorium, which is at the Palace of Fine Arts, and I did post a picture of that because we were at a Peter Thiel was nice enough to host a party for us attendees last night, which was at his home, which is right over near there. So that's actually the connection between last time I put that up. But the Hyatt Regency Hotel here at the Embarcadero, right here on the bay, is where the event's taking place this time. And I don't know if they've had it here before. I kind of think maybe not, but I'm not sure.
That was an awesome non-name drop there, by the way. Peter Thiel's party, I'm about to hear it. You say that so nonchalantly. I love that film.
I wasn't sure that I was supposed to talk
about. I know. I'm picking, man. I'm just. You know what it is? I'm jealous. I'm not there. That's what it comes down to. I just wish I were there, and I just throw out that dig. At any rate,
Stephen, he asked about you. Okay.
That's right. I'm sure he did. Well, we have a guest tonight too, Phil, and we may want to bring him out too.
Let's bring him right out. We're so pleased to have back with us Canadian futurist, consultant, and award-winning blogger, George Dvorsky. We all know him from his work at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and also his wonderful blog, Sentient Developments. George, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you, guys. Good evening, gentlemen. How y'all doing?
Excellent.
Super fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing well. Enjoying the weekend and following as best as I can anyways. The goings-on in San Francisco and the Singularity Summit. It's pretty great when you've got Twitter and Facebook up. You can do a pretty decent job following the events as they're happening. So that's kind of been my window today to the summit.
Well, Steve and I were actually talking before the program began about how the most recent H+ summit, they did a live video feed of all the of all the sessions, which was, I thought, a brilliant idea. They're not going that far with Singularity Summit at this point. I think there's an issue of competing with your own content, and there's concerns about that. Plus, I'm thinking that's probably a large undertaking to push a signal like that out onto the internet. But it's pretty close. I mean, there's an awful lot of what's going on that you can get. There's numerous bloggers. Surf Daddy Orca is doing it for H+, Brian Wong's here. He's got it going on his blog. Of course, I'm doing it on Speculus, and we're talking about it here tonight on Fast Forward Radio, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much coverage of it and so much discussion of it that although the sessions themselves aren't live on the internet, it almost feels like an event that's occurring online.
Absolutely. I mean, there really is. I mean, I did see some people were complaining in the beginning that they wanted the live video. I guess they were spoiled by what had happened at the H+ summit at Harvard. And people were also asking that some of the slide show presentations be, for example, shared on a service like SlideShare, for example. But that being said, I mean, that would be great, absolutely. But as you stated, just following the, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all the live blogging that went on or any other kind of social media, you pretty much still had virtually the same sort of experience. I mean, there's really, as long as you kind of looked around and paid a bit of attention, there was really, I think, not a whole lot of loss or being at a disadvantage, you know, relative to not having the videos or the slide share up.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably true. Although, and this is not in a rub it in way at all, guys. I should say there's a lot to be said for actually being at the event. The interaction with the people here is a wonderful thing. I say that not in a you guys don't have it as good as me way, but just in a way, just in a to encourage people listening, if at all possible, to try to make one of these times. Because
I can absolutely relate to that as a person who loves going out to conferences. For me, it's about quite literally about 25. I get about 25% out of the conference itself, and 75% is in meeting the people there and networking and interacting and just bouncing ideas off people and having your mind blown at every turn when you're speaking with people. That to me is the essence and the real heart of any conference.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of which, I've got three clips from conversations I've had with folks around the conference. In fact, I've done four interviews since I've been here. I did one with Christine Peterson last night, and she had some really exciting things to say about a conference that she's put together. You may have seen some information on it, you guys. A conference she's putting together on the subject of life extension. And I had a great little audio clip of her talking about that, and I incorrectly hit a button on my little digital recorder, and I unfortunately have done away with that. So I'm going to try to capture tomorrow and see if I can get that on a subsequent show. But we do have three clips, one from a speaker at the conference and two from people that I've just run into, one whom I knew before and one I just met last night and found to be very interesting and found that he had some interesting stuff to say. So we'll get into those a little bit later. But that is one of the real benefits, I think, of making it to an event like this, which is the conversations that go on around the coffee urn, coming and going from sessions around lunch, and just getting FaceTime with people who have truly fascinating, interesting perspectives on the world. But before we get into those interesting perspectives, Stephen, did you see the commentary that I got from one random attendee who singled me out and said, "Hey, I listened to your podcast"?
I did not. Tell us about that.
Okay. So right after the morning session, somebody walks up to me and is like, "Oh, hey, I listened to your podcast." I'm like, "Great." And he goes, "Well, I want to make it constructive criticism."
Oh, no. Okay.
I'm sure you do. Please do make a constructive criticism. So he finds us to be. I want to characterize this correctly. I want to use the words he did. Folksy and rambling. Okay. Now, I heard that, and I, of course, those words have been going through my head all day after this guy lays that one on me. Now, we're going to check in with George here in just a moment because he's completely unbiased, and he'll give us the real assessment of our program. But it occurred to me that the folksy thing, that's all you, Stephen, okay? That's all about you, all right? And, okay, the rambling thing, now that is totally you, okay? So I get the
credit and the blame.
I think this guy is saying he's got a problem with you. Okay, that's
maybe so. Well, you know what? I'm gonna just throw this out there. These are not meant to be bugs. They're features. You know, I mean, the ramblingness and the folksiness. It's the show is not for everybody. This show is only meant for the sexy people. Okay.
There you go. My response was that half of that is by design. Folksy, we're trying to do a somewhat different approach to this material. So if it comes off as a little too aw-shucks for you, you know, hey, maybe you don't keep listening. I'm just throwing that out there as a possibility. But the rambling
double your money back.
Yeah, we might work on that. that's one. I know that I tend to trail off into esoteric, albeit fascinating areas sometimes. So I did take it as constructive criticism. I'm going to work on the I'm going to work on the rambling thing. But folks, see, that's what you get. Okay, you tune into this show. That's what we're all about here. So now, having said all that, and leaped to our own defense, George, take us home here. Huh? What do you think? I don't know what to say about that.
I mean, the rambling thing, I don't get that at all. Maybe what he's thinking there, what he's hearing. I mean, you have an entire hour with which to work within. It's an hour show, right?
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, that means it can be paced, and you can kind of dig a little deeper and become conversational, even familiar with each other, and talk about. I mean, sometimes you guys, you know, bring about what's going on in your daily lives and so on, and that maybe that's also kind of part of the folksy part of it as well. And well, how long have you guys been doing this show now?
We're coming up
about
on
5.
Three.
Yeah,
about 5 years, but as a weekly thing, we're coming up on 3 years.
That's amazing. I mean, just to have that, you guys have had that kind of longevity. I mean, and I don't know how similar kinds of radio broadcasts, even if they're internet-based, how, you know, the kind of longevity that's there. But I think there's, you know, I mean, give some credit where credit is due, and I think that just simply by having the consistency and by having, you know, this kind of track record, that kind of speaks to itself. And I'm sure you've got a loyal set of followers and listeners, and I'm certainly one of them. And I kind of, you know what, maybe that can be thrown at you as a pejorative, the whole rambling, folksy thing. But to me, if I were you guys, I would take that as a compliment. And really, for me, ultimately, what it comes down to is the content and the quality of what you're talking about and the quality of your guests. And you guys have phenomenal guests that are always worth listening to. And the content is spot on. I mean, what else are you going to listen to? Like shows about UFOs and paranormal crap? Like, I mean, you guys pretty much stick to the science. And you stick to the you know, some pretty credible futurism. And sure, I mean, I can understand some people maybe having some complaints that it might be a little too glass half full at times. But that's kind of the angle. I mean, that's kind of like the essence of your show, is looking at the kind of brighter side of what kind of future we can actually have. So that I'll take that any day over, you know, some of the whack job type radio shows that are out there.
And
the glass half full. We're just balancing out, you know, the rest of the media world. You know, they can be pessimistic all the time, and
that's the thing. There's
just trying to look at the other side.
No shortage of a bleak outlook. If you want to find one, they're out there. I mean, that's available. But thanks for those words, George. That's very nice of you to say. And, you know, we'll probably keep having you back on. Really, I think. Fairly likely that we will continue to have you as a guest in the future. I think. Okay, well, let's get into what some of these folks have to say, and I'm trying to decide who we want to hear from first. Actually, I'm going to take a guess, George, that you must know Stephen Mann. Is that right?
Yes. Back in 2000, just as a kind of a sidebar, back in 2004, I organized the WTA, the World Transhumanist Association's Transvision Conference in Toronto. And obviously, Steve Mann, being from Toronto, he was a local guest that we had come on. So I've met Steve, and I know that from personal experience, he puts on a phenomenal presentation. So I'm very eager to hear how his presentation went today.
Well, he true to form, this is my first opportunity to see him live, my first opportunity to meet him. I saw him at the party last night, and I had seen him around this morning. I didn't know who he was, and frankly, this will be, you know, I think not completely surprising. I took him to be someone with a disability, because, you know, you see a guy, I mean, it's summertime, and he's got this, like, wintertime sock hat on, and he's got on these glasses, one of which has this enormous lens. And if you don't know what the deal is, you think, oh, well, this guy's got an issue, and that's okay. I mean, not there's anything wrong with that. I didn't mean it in a judgmental way. That's just what I saw, right? I mean, that was what I perceived that I was seeing. But that's not the reality. What Stephen Mann actually is he is a cyborg. He lives his life wired, and I guess he's had computers of one type or another attached to him for about 30 years now. We saw clips of him wearing much bigger, heavier, more elaborate, lower tech cameras years back. Nowadays, it's down to pretty much a very elegant kind of a webcam that's covering one lens of the eyeglasses. And once you know what's going on, you look at it, and suddenly you don't see a disabled person. You see almost kind of a superhero. You know, I mean, it's amazing the transformation that takes place as soon as you understand what you're looking at. But he gave a fascinating talk on what he calls the undigital singularity, and we'll talk about that in a little bit after we've given him an opportunity to talk. And he performed some music on his hydraulophone, which I noticed now in my blog post I misspelled because I spoke to him after the fact and I got the correct spelling of that. George, you familiar with the hydraulophone?
Yes, in fact, I've played it.
Tell our listeners about the hydraulophone.
Oh, it's the strangest thing you'll ever see, and I had an opportunity to play it at Nuit Blanche, which is something we do in Toronto, and a bunch of other cities have been doing it now, where the entire city is alive for the entire 24-hour span. So it was probably around like 2 or 3 in the morning, and I stumbled upon this rather large-looking metallic object with, it's almost impossible to describe, but it had a number of, it basically looked like a leaky pipe, and with a whole bunch of holes in it, and it was emitting a tone, and you could manipulate the tone by in a way plugging the water valves as they were leaking out. It was, so you were getting wet, your hands were getting soaked actually, but as you were altering or plugging in the leaky holes, you were kind of altering the pitch at the same time, and it made a kind of a marvelously aqua-like tone, and you could kind of, once you kind of figured out how it worked, you could actually kind of play it. So probably a terrible description, but that's the best I can do. You kind of think you have to kind of see it to kind of understand it.
Yeah, it's this somewhere between a flute and a pipe organ, but its medium is not air, as would be used by either of those two instruments. Its medium is water. So it's got these holes with water shooting out them, and if you block the holes with your fingers, music comes out. It's the most astounding thing. The music is actually being made by the water rushing through the hydraulophone, and it's a very soothing experience. This kind of a touch sensation of feeling the water and making musical notes at the same time. It's very different from what you experience when you hit a piano keyboard or you know, when you blow into a trumpet or something like that. It's just its own very, very unique experience. And I took videos of one of the volunteers playing chopsticks, and I also took one of Steve himself playing House of the Rising Sun, which was awesome, but the audio on that it didn't come out at all, unfortunately, so I'm not going to get that one up on YouTube. I do have the other one. I'm trying to get that up on YouTube. Hopefully the audio will be a little bit legible, but it was very noisy in that room. And the sound of the hydraulophone is so ephemeral that it's kind of hard to get it above the din of the crowd. But hopefully we'll have some of that. Anyway, Stephen, let's go ahead and cue the clip and let's listen to what Stephen Mann has to say, and we'll come back and we'll talk about that a little bit. Oh, Stephen, before you.
I'm talking with Dr. Stephen.
I'm sorry, Phil. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. This is the engineer. I was just going to say, I apologize in advance. I think the sound quality is a little bad on this one, too, again, just because of the room noise. So, sorry. Go ahead.
And I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Mann from the University of Toronto, following up to his talk at the Singularity Summit. Stephen is the world's first cyborg, and he's entertained us with some music on the, once again,
hydraulophone.
The hydraulophone. Stephen, I have a question for you regarding the wearing of the video camera at all times. Do you have trouble getting through airport security?
So certainly with anything that's permanently attached to the body, any sort of cyborg technology, it creates unique challenges. And basically it's sort of difficult enough that I tend to travel, you know, for paid speaking engagements like keynote address or something like that. But I don't just travel around a lot frivolously.
Okay, so it's not something you encounter that frequently?
Yeah, so I do, I just allow, budget myself to allow for working within the constraints.
I see. What about there was another question about are you wired in 24 hours a day? Do you sleep like this? Does it go on all the time, or how does that work?
So any sort of cyborg technology is often permanently attached, and it becomes your perceptual experience or the way that you understand and understand the world. In many ways, it's sort of like a third hemisphere of the brain, as Adam Ranchuk once said, that it's like a true extension of the mind and body in the Manfred Klein sense. And so what you have is something that becomes, I think, especially as we see the growing population of elderly, I think we're going to see more and more of these sorts of things where we're trying to do life extension and continually replace parts of the body and mind.
When you first attached a computer to yourself 30 years ago, did you think that 3 decades later you'd still be doing the same thing?
I sort of did it as a quick experiment initially, but I found this symbiosis to be quite effective in certain areas and certain ways, and so I stayed with it for a while. Like many inventions, it takes some time of experimentation. You know, both the Wearcomp and the hydraulophone, for example, are inventions that I've worked on for many, many years.
And what in particular are you looking forward to in terms of the development of technology? I know you've made a number of inventions yourself. So either in terms of new developments you're working on or things that you look forward to see come down the pike to enhance the experience as you've known it over the years.
Some of the new inventions, some inventions take time to get off the ground, like the cyborg technology that is taking a while to take effect. On the hydraulophone front, we've had quite a bit of, that's one of my inventions, the underwater pipe organ that is now seeing quite a bit of installation in various water parks around the world and places like that. So it's a very simple invention, and what we do is what we call fluid media. Undigital media, continuously fluid, new kinds of human-machine interaction that are at the heart of this concept of fluid media.
And finally, one last question. Can you distinguish for me the difference between the digital singularity and the undigital singularity?
Okay, so the undigital singularity is this concept that I've proposed in which the word length increases to the point where, let me say, as the word length, the number of bits, say, representing each data point, if it increases linearly, then of course the quantization noise decreases and the step size decreases exponentially, and which means the signal-to-noise ratio increases exponentially. But if the and we know that an exponential increase, like Moore's law, for example, doesn't give rise to a singularity in and of itself. It has to be more something of a hyperbolic nature. So there's an asymptote in time somewhere where it increases without bound. And so what I've identified is that in fluid media, like continuously fluid media, things like mediated reality and cyborg technology, I believe it's going to hit a singularity, an asymptote that will occur much sooner than the AI singularity.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed talking with you.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, I really appreciate it.
Went on just a little bit longer than I expected, but the last part there was something that I really wanted to capture because that was core to his talk, this idea of the undigital singularity. And what that has to do with, as he explained there, I actually talked with him about it further because, as I mentioned in the blog post, I was having a little trouble getting my head around it. But as I understand it, what he's talking about is this exponential growth in our ability to record, capture continuous phenomena. And he's this walking example of it with the video camera that is recording, capturing this live feed of his life at all times. And the undigital singularity has to do with ultimately reaching this point where we can have it all the time. Now that's at the same time an astounding thought and a very kind of sobering and frightening thought to a lot of people. But let me pass that one to you, George. Did I get the idea right? As you understand what he's talking about, and what's your thoughts on digital singularity?
Well, I think that he's probably half right, and there's, or more accurate, what I mean there. I think there's some real truth to what he has to say, but it's funny. Like any specialist, they will tend to kind of focus and even fetishize their own area of research. So for Steve Mann, of course, everything's about the cyborg. But even if you dig a bit deeper and scratch the surface, you kind of realize that Steve's not all too keen on, for example, implantable cybernetic technologies and more invasive type of augmentations and enhancements. For him, it's very much about the wearable sphere. And it's because of that I think there's a bit of a credibility loss as well there. Not that I'm going to pick on Steve in particular, but I think that anyone who's going to start to predict even things like singularities, whether they be the so-called undigital or digital singularities, needs to take, a more expansive look at the converging technologies. So, yes, I mean, clearly cybernetic technologies and wearables are going to be absolutely an important part of where we're headed as a species and what we're going to be doing as individuals and how we communicate. I mean, right now, I'm already starting to, even today, I'm looking at things like iPhones and other handheld devices as being anachronistic in principle. It is ridiculous when you look around and all you do are see people carrying these ridiculously, you know, clunky, funny-looking devices. And I keep thinking, why can't these things be a bit more integrative, whether it be something that we would wear in our clothing or on things like on our contact lenses, or even further afield into things that can actually be integrated into our body such that it's almost a seamless integration, which is this space that Steve's a little bit uncomfortable with. But not only that, when we talk about converging technologies, we should also include the things like genetic augmentations and other things that we can do, for example, neurologically, and all those sorts of different areas that we've discussed. Nanotechnology is another example of where we're headed, and other ways we can integrate information technology into our lives. So I think that, like I said, I think there's some truth to what Steve has to say, but I think there's a much, much bigger picture in terms of how we could potentially modify the species in a way that would be a bit more disruptive and a bit more impactful. And as to actually how that translates to a singularity per se, I'm afraid he kind of loses me a bit there because we are, I don't think that the conversation there is really touching upon greater than human artificial intelligence and the whole recursive improvement idea. That might be a fault on my part. It might be just ignorant of what he's actually saying there, but I'm sensing a bit of a disconnect there. I'm not sure if you agree.
Yeah, I think
I wouldn't mind hearing some of your thoughts on it.
Well, I think his undigital singularity is—he says we might get there first, and it's just—it's the world where we're capturing all the continuous, recording all the continuous stuff while it occurs. Now, I noticed that Sally in the chat room says that we'll have the nanotech singularity, if you want to call it that, before we have this undigital one. So, Stephen, we got a horse race going on singularities. Where are you going to put your money?
Well. You know, it's funny. We've had this conversation many times. Which do we get first, the ability to grow back a hand or the Luke Skywalker hand?
Right.
You know,
I noticed that in that dichotomy, though, we don't have this undigital one on the table at all. Now, Stephen Mann has introduced a new one. So does that one resonate with you as a possibility, or do you have the same kind of, like, doubts about it
I'm coming at it from a slightly different direction than George, but I come to the same conclusion as him. I say that the shocking value of what Steve Mann has done over the last 30 years is coming to an end. We're all cyborgs now in the sense that Stephen Mann is. And why is that? We all carry cell phones, which is a form of high friction telepathy, if you ask me, because what you've got here is the ability to talk to anybody you care to talk to all the time, and they have the ability to talk to you any at all times. And you know, sometimes we have to turn it off, but you know, just have a moment of peace. But that's that's cyborg technology. And then of course, now that all of our cell phones just about have become smartphones, half of us are walking around with iPhones, and then the rest with Androids practically. So we always have the internet with us. We always have social networks with us. You know, we can always share pictures of, you know, and all our phones are cameras, so we can share that. And And so we can even, in some sense, we're glogging too, because we can even take videos all the time and share them on YouTube immediately. So it's the world has caught up to Stephen Mann, and will probably go far, much farther than he's gone very soon. So
yeah, well, I would say it is catching up. I mean, this goes back, George, to your comments about the discussion we were having just a few minutes ago about how live this event is, even without it being broadcast. Everyone's capturing this, not everyone, but a lot of people are capturing it and reporting on the continuous experience in sort of the manner he's talking about. So I do see this massive explosion, I guess, of capturing of phenomena while it occurs. I think that is true, and I think we are, Stephen, to your point, becoming much more equipped at doing it. I do choke on the word singularity, George, just as you did. I don't see how that quite factors in. And I have to agree with Sally, and with you, Stephen, that the technology's got to be there first. That it's actually the technology that's going to drive it. And I do want better technology for doing this. I don't want to walk around with a kind of a monocle looking camera on an eyeglass as he does. But I would very much like to have captured that hydraulophone session better than I was able to on my iPhone video camera. I wish I had gotten good audio, and I wish that it had gone straight to YouTube rather than the one video I did get. I'm having a little bit of trouble getting it up there. And, I mean, that's the high friction that you're talking about, right, Stephen?
Right, exactly.
So,
the day's going to come when we get it, when we have these things much as George has described. I mean, we have, when our cell phone is built into our audio nerve, and our video camera is built into our eyes, so and we share what we care to, and we keep what we want private. So it's going to be interesting to see how fast we get these things.
I have to make an observation about this. Speaking of high friction and capturing data, capturing experience in real time, in the chat room, Sally's trying to make a point about Dick Tracy, and the Blog Talk Radio chat device is censoring her talking about Dick Tracy.
Star,
they ought to know. Sally wouldn't use inappropriate language in the chat room.
Talking about his camera, his video wristwatch, right?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
The joke is it's blurring out the word, his first name. Okay, anyway, we'll move on. I'm sorry, George, unless you had any other thoughts on Stephen Mann, we'll move on to our next question.
That pretty much expressed my thoughts.
Okay, cool. Before I go to the next audio clip, I just wanted to talk quickly about two things I heard this morning that I found incredibly exciting. And I don't know if we'll get a chance to speak to either of these speakers, so I just want to mention them. And now I can't find the – oh, here he is. Gregory Stock, talking about evolution and post-human intelligence, gave a very interesting talk on this. I don't want to get into that because it would be a whole show talking about that. I want to talk about he sidebarred just for a few minutes and talked about the work he's doing at Sigma Biosciences. He's the CEO and founder of that company, and they've been working on Alzheimer's research. He views – Alzheimer's research is the poster child for unmet medical needs. He talks about the prevalence of it. If you make it to 85, you have a 50% chance of getting Alzheimer's. So it's this is a massively significant issue that we're dealing with in this country, and it's the downside of the life extension that we've achieved up to this point, which is that we've got people living a lot longer. But that means we're also pushing a lot of people into this, or we're extending the time they spend in that. So he talks about how they started looking at proteins and the role that they play. And they isolated one called PP2A. It may be the key. And they started looking for things to activate it. And I don't know, Stephen, if you read this post?
I don't believe so.
Okay. So any wild guesses on what will activate this protein that prevents Alzheimer's? I will tell you that after I found out what it was, I wrote down the word yay. Okay.
Well, let me just throw this out, because I've read something recently about what you can do to prevent Alzheimer's, and the biggest thing is to expose yourself to new experiences and new ideas.
Okay, well, that's a beautiful thought, and I'm sure it helps. But no, that was not what he named. I don't know, George. Have you heard of this, or do you want to take a guess?
I heard because I was kind of following just through the my Twitter sphere, so I do know the answer. But
give us the good news, and I'll respond as I did.
It's coffee or caffeine. Yay! Specifically. It is good news.
4 cups per day reduces incidence of diabetes and Parkinson's. I'm like, you got to be kidding here. You know, the thing I've been feeling the most guilty about, right, is that I can't get off coffee no matter what I do. Turns out coffee bean extract, Sig 1012, administered to mice, extends life and delays motor problems, and apparently drastically reduces incidence of diabetes and appears to prevent Parkinson's disease. So,
well, you know, Phil, since, I think you have a significantly lower a risk factor for Parkinson's or other dementia than the general population because, number one, you consume your fair share of caffeine. Number two, you are exposing yourself to new ideas and new concepts and thinking all the time. So there you are.
There you go. I'm covering my bases on this.
You are covering your bases, man. That's awesome.
And I'm sorry if I cut you off, George. Was there more you wanted to say on the subject of coffee?
Just that, I mean, don't believe the anti-coffee hype, which still exists out there quite rampantly. Like you mentioned that you feel guilty every time you have a cup of coffee. But I think, for example, I think it was about a year or two ago, the conclusion of a long-term Harvard study, which was at least 10 years long, I mean, they did their darndest to try to find something wrong with caffeine specifically, and they could not. I mean, other than the obvious short-term effects, which are both positive and negative of how a stimulant works, there were no long-term deleterious effects that they could detect from caffeine. And now we're discovering through the work of individuals such as Greg Stock and others that, in fact, there might even be some pretty profound long-term benefits as long as we keep drinking coffee. Mind you, I just want to add just a quick caveat there about its work against fighting diabetes. Obviously, if you put 2 and 3 and 4 scoops of sugar in your coffee,
that might offset it somewhat.
But, yeah, I just thought I'd throw that out there for those people order the double-double and think that they're kind of getting off scot-free. They're not.
In addition to the caffeine, there's also some pretty powerful antioxidants in coffee. So there's lots of things to like about coffee.
Good things to know about. I mean, first they started explaining to us why we need to drink wine. Thank you very much. And now it's coffee. So Sally Chocolate is close behind. I'm sure that they're going to be. Actually, I believe they already have talked extensively about some
dark chocolate.
Chocolate. Yeah.
So I want to talk about Ben Goertzel, but I want to make sure we get our audio clips in. So why don't we go ahead and Stephen, let's hear what Peter Vandermeid has to say. I met him last night at the reception, one of those, how's it going, is this your first Singularity Summit? And he started talking to me about the work that he's doing, and I'm just completely fascinated by it. We're going to have him back on the program, I think, for a full hour in the near future, and I'm thinking I'll probably write a longer piece on this subject, possibly for H Plus Magazine, but let's get just a little flavor of it here with the chat I had with him this morning.
All right, I'm talking with Peter Vandermeid of WISP, and Peter is working on building a hardware-based model of the human brain. Peter, how did you get interested in doing such a project?
We started very early. We started in about 1986 with a parallel processing system that we were going to model on the human brain, and the reading about the human brain is, you can't help but being overwhelmed by the way it works.
So what was your background? What was it that led you to be pursuing that kind of a project?
Well, my background is in computer science. So having worked in computer science for quite a few years, I kind of got bored with it. I wanted to do something different. I always had an interest in medicine and biology, and I basically went back to my old interest.
So what progress have you made to date towards building a hardware-based brain? Is it a brain model, a replica? How do you describe it?
Well, we started building an exact model of a neuron. we first did it on a parallel processor, and then we found out we were using too much circuitry for the little bit bang. So we decided to throw away the processor ID, which is hard to do for a computer scientist, and decided to go with something that's completely new. And we started by building the synapse in gates, in 220 gates. Eventually, we built a function of the synapse that looked very much like a biological synapse in its function.
So to date, what's the total number of synapses that you can put on a chip?
Well, we used FPGA technology, and the number of in an FPGA is not very high because you can only use one gate in each cell. So we succeeded in putting 160 synapses and 10 neurons on a chip, and we've been experimenting with that with a spectrum analyzer feeding into it, and we could teach the system to recognize sounds from 400 to 500 hertz.
Okay, so and how many neurons can you put on a chip?
With ASIC technology, we can get up to 15,000 neurons.
Okay, so with 15,000 neurons, and you said about 10 synapses, you're at the point where at least you can do some basic pattern recognition that a brain might do.
It's not so much pattern recognition, and also the number of synapses on that chip is 240,000.
Sorry, I got that wrong. All right.
Yeah. So with 240 synapses and 15,000 neurons, we hope to be able to do some really good speech recognition.
So how long till you have a full replica of a human brain, and what would the practical application, if any, of this technology be in the meantime?
In the meantime, you know, Intel did not start with the Pentium processor. We start at a much lower level. We're starting with a chip of 15,000 neurons, which is only a fraction of the human brain. But we learned from it, and each model of chip has increased its complexity and its model. And the fact that these neurons are learning, and we can see that the synapse values are changing as a result of experience, of unlabeled data, is very encouraging.
Can you name any specific applications it might be put to?
Yeah, specific applications, we are looking at Cochlear. Cochlear is an Australian manufacturer of implants, cochlear implants. They currently are doing their processing with signal processors. We would like to use our chip in there instead, so they increase the spectrum of sounds that they can recognize.
I believe when we were talking about this earlier, you said that this might enable cochlear implant users to hear music.
That's right, yes. Yes.
Which would be a major step forward for that. So one last question. How long till you have a full brain?
Emulation of a full brain would take 6.6 million chips. That's a lot of circuitry at this time, but because it's clocked at a very low rate, it's clocked at only 14 kilohertz, it would stay very cool and would be a much better proposition than using that many microprocessors.
By contrast, how many Pentium chips do you think it would take to make a human brain?
Well, a Pentium can simulate about 800 complex neuron models, as we are using. So work it out. 100 billion divided by 800.
It's much farther to go. Well, thank you very much for your time, and best of luck to you, Peter.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right.
Okay, so a couple of things I want to point out about that. But before I do, just a little bit of the backstory on him, because I didn't capture that in the audio interview, although I did talking with him last night. This gentleman has been interested in replicating in hardware, in computer systems, biological systems. So this has been kind of his fascination throughout his entire career. And prior to this project, he had put together what he described as an immune system, which he sold that to IBM for in the neighborhood of $50 million, which money he is now using to fund this project. He's got six guys down in Australia, and they're working on creating a hardware version of the brain. This raises a couple of interesting discussion points. One is the hardware versus software debate, which I think, interestingly, Terry Sijnowski's discussion about reverse engineering of brains being within reach touched on that a little bit this afternoon when he was talking about the difference between this computer program that taught itself how to play backgammon to the world grandmaster level using just a very simple learning heuristic versus IBM's Deep Blue, which was this very sophisticated, dedicated piece of hardware that had this whole team of engineers coding on it. That sort of implies that maybe the in Sajnowski's views anyway, the hardware approach isn't the right way to go. I think it's interesting though that both ideas are being entertained. The other thing is just the thought of, well, what are the applications? Where can you go with computer chips that work like human neurons? Well, as Sajnowski was talking, he was talking about how in a narrow AI sense, what we would have to call a narrow AI sense, programming these kinds of capabilities in gives you ultimately a cognitive power grid, cognitive cars, cognitive homes, just this entire environment that's beginning to think a little bit more like people. So one of the things that's interested me about my discussion with Peter is the possibility that, well, if that is indeed the direction we're going, if we're attuning our environment to think more like we do, then maybe the hardware platform we would want to run that on is one that is structured the way our brains are. Maybe that's a bad idea, but he might be onto something. I'm not sure. What do you think, George?
That's really food for thought there. I mean, making our technologies, particularly those obviously that require some processing and even some mild AI to start thinking in the same way that a human brain would think. I mean, that's clearly a fascinating angle. I'd have to think that a bit through because clearly there still has to be some kind of a user interface and some kind of function that you want to get out of the device that you're actually working with to make it work for you. So it's fascinating. I do think that was a really interesting clip, and thanks for sharing it. And what I really enjoy about it and why I like it so much as well is because I do think that fellows like that and work like that, it really is in the right direction because they are looking to replicate or mimic biological systems that are effectively doing something correctly that we're still trying to figure out how to do ourselves and not having to kind of reinvent the wheel here and just trying to model what's really working that kind of came up in nature. And I'm kind of, in terms of the whole brain emulation versus, the kind of the hard coding debate, I tend to lean more toward the whole brain emulation camp, only because I think there's so much data around us and so many examples of how a functioning cognitive system can work around us that we're going to just feed off that. And where I kind of maybe disagree a little bit is the not sure anyone specifically expressed this particular sentiment, but that it's going to be through this kind of work and this kind of work alone that we'll get a whole brain. That's obviously that's not going to happen. I mean, what he's kind of doing there is kind of creating the brute strength and even mimicking the exact processes that powers the brain. But the actual, modulation of the brain and the finer details as to how, the brain actually works and gives rise to all the various cognitive capacities, that's going to be somebody else's workshop. But I guess ultimately what I'm trying to say is it'll be through his work and the work of many other teams in their particular areas of focus that we probably will create, probably will be able to emulate an entire brain someday. So I think his work sounds pretty important.
Yeah, I agree. And I should note that both in the recorded conversation that I had with him today and in talking with him last night, he never quite said, and this will give you a real working brain. I think that he is okay. Interested in the hardware of it, but he's not actually suggesting that this is necessarily the thing that gets you to that, or that this is necessarily the thing that gets you to greater than human intelligence or human level intelligence.
Right. It's good that you made that distinction or even made that clarification because IBM has not.
Right.
They had that real ridiculous claim a few months ago about that they had emulated a cat brain and all the lazy journalists out there and reporters and bloggers quickly jumped on it and said, oh my goodness, they've got a cat brain. And, you know, it's far from what they were really trying to say in a very poor and irresponsible sort of a way, was that they were kind of, you know, kind of set up an array here, a computer array, in such a way that it probably had a similar kind of cognitive or rather processing strength that a cat brain has, which is really far from any kind of, you know, functioning, you know, cat brain. So it's good that, or important also, that we do make these kinds of distinctions.
Yeah, I think so too. Because when you clear out that level of hype, then you can start to see what the value might actually be. I mean, I'm all for somebody making an actual working model of a brain that you know, really is like a human brain, and whether that's done hardware or software or some interesting combo of the two, or however it eventually happens, or whether we get to human level intelligence purely through you know, a whole cloth coded solution. There's still a lot of interesting, valuable stuff that can be done with technology like this along the way. I think is
Phil,
the point we don't want to lose.
Phil, can I interject with a question?
Sure.
Curious to know, seeing as you're there, boots on the ground, one of the things that I would have liked to have kind of sussed out had I been there is to get maybe a feeling as to where we're headed in this field or in this particular area of inquiry. If I was to kind of put you on the spot and ask you, what was your sense? Are more people leaning toward the whole brain emulation camp, or are more people leaning more toward the kind of the Ben Gertzel-esque, you know, we can kind of figure this out from scratch and figure out the algorithms and the codes ourselves? Where do you think the sentiment was kind of gravitating toward?
I think the sentiment is gravitating towards the Ben Gertzel approach, but I think there's not a lot of pure, hard, and fast, okay, that maybe people are starting to recognize that it might be something more or less that we create, that we develop, but it might at the same time be heavily informed by what we're learning from emulating the brain, that might give us
right.
the added boost we need. When Ray Kurzweil talked about Lisp this morning, that was really interesting to me, that I've done a little Lisp programming in many years ago, and I never knew that there was a whole body of scholarly work, or at least a kind of a movement going on where people were saying, yes, Lisp is right because this is how the human brain works, and you can make these one-dimensional lists, and you can add complexity by nesting lists within lists, and we're going to understand, we're going to be able to create intelligent machines because that's how our brains work. When there was no good reason to believe that our brains actually work that way. But 25 years later, Kurzweil is saying, actually, it turns out, yeah, it looks like they pretty much work the way Lisp said. So there's this interesting back and forth, there's interesting conversation between modeling the brain and ideas that we come up with. And it seems like in some instances, the ones we come up with that are closer to the brain, I think, maybe move us a little farther. But just one more comment on that question, because I think that's a great question. In the past, I've noticed that these events, it feels to me like the tendency is for people to want to go in the presenters have had a kind of a bias towards the brain emulation model. But I always feel it's kind of groundswell of support from the audience for the for the Ben Gertzel approach. So I wonder if that may have kind of a grassroots, maybe that's starting to bubble up into the into who they get to talk or how they're presenting this, because it feels a lot more balanced than it has in the past.
You know, I think there's obviously a very smart audience there, Phil, but I think that you would almost have to be a Ben Gertzel to have an educated opinion on these things. As far as underselling the audience.
I can't say that much, Stephen. It doesn't slow me down one bit.
you're gonna have a opinion right anyway. That's great.
But you're right. I mean, I think that when Ben and Ray disagree on this, that's probably different than when you and I do, right? What you're saying.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a difference between, us in a fist fight versus heavyweight champions. You know, I mean, it's a different deal. But I just thought I'd throw this out. If there's 240,000 synapses on the chip, and there's 10 to the 13th synapses in the brain, that's we'll have to improve by 9 orders of magnitude to have the same number of synapses. Now, I wonder what Ray Kurzweil would say about the time frame of that kind of improvement. Now, of course, you know, what George says is absolutely true. You know, even if you get that many synapses, that doesn't mean we got a emulated human brain, but it's an easy way to measure it, I guess.
Well, not to speak for Ray Kurzweil, but I think what he was I think his answer is this hardware thing isn't necessarily my solution anyhow. But as Peter said, it's 60 million chips, right? So you're right. It's that many. That is 9 orders of magnitude to get to there. But you don't have to have it all on one chip, right? So maybe he can go up 8 orders of magnitude, and we can have it all on 10 million chips or 6 million chips or something like that. But we're running very desperately low on time, and I do want to get to our final clip, which I don't think is going to run us over. I think it's considerably shorter. Let's go ahead and play this. This is a quick one, and I think a good note to end on.
Okay.
Talking with Patrick Friedman of the Seasetting Institute. Patrick, what brings you to the Singularity Summit?
Well, there's a lot in common with the Singularity ideas and seasetting. This is where people who are using technology to make a better future come and hang out and talk and learn from each other, and that's what we're trying to do with the Seasetting Institute.
Give us a quick rundown on what seasetting is all about.
Seasteading is building startup countries in international waters. We have a really different view on politics. We think the issue is not about who gets elected or what party gets elected, but about the fact that there's no startups. There's no way that someone with an idea about a really new, different, better political system can go try it. And so the technology of politics doesn't evolve because there's no experiments, no startups.
Fascinating. I see that you've got the Scientific American with the story on how humanity almost escaped extinction. What's the connection between that and seasteading?
Well, seasteading, among other things, will help us not go extinct by spreading us about the globe and putting us in the oceans, which is very robust against things like biological plagues and zombie attacks.
Excellent. We're always on the lookout for protection from zombie attacks. Thanks very much for your time, Patrick.
No problem. As long as there's no zombie sharks, we're okay.
We got to be careful.
I love that.
I wanted to give a little flavor for the diversity of opinions and the interesting people you get to talk to when you attend the Singularity Summit. Patrick, obviously completely serious about seasteading. I think facetious about the worry of zombie sharks. But since we've kept you up after midnight to be on the program tonight, George, thoughts on seasteading or zombies, either one, quickly in about 3 minutes.
The seasteading thing. I haven't given it too much thought. It really kind of does harken back, I suppose, to early colonial days where disgruntled Europeans have said enough is enough, and we're going to go over to the New World and create a city upon a hill and do things our way, only to find that it, you know, eventually kind of regresses back to, you know, the way they used to be in the old country. You know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss type thing. And I think the seasteaders maybe are, without having any kind of real specific political system, perhaps something, I'm sensing a libertarian streak here, maybe some kind of an arrangement that they think they can kind of avoid paying taxes and by doing the seasteading thing. That's the kind of sense that I'm getting. So I'm somewhat pessimistic and a bit cynical about the whole enterprise, but at the same time, even somewhat mildly excited about it because, I hate, and I always don't, and I don't want to ever be that kind of naysayer for those that have got great ideas. And you know what? If you have an idea and you want to get this going and get this working, go for it, man. You know, prove everybody wrong. Like get a great little political entity going and see where she goes. So while I'm pessimistic on the one hand, I would at the same time encourage them to kind of try to see if they can figure it out.
Well, I love the idea of trying lots of different things, and I have to say that I just love the name startup countries. That appeals to me, you know, that you get this fresh wave of startup companies. The idea of startup countries appeals to me somehow, that we might we might infuse fresh blood. Well, we're completely out of time. George Dvorsky, thanks so much for being with us. And we're going to do a follow-up show probably in about a week. If you'd like to come back and talk more Singularity Summit, we'd love to have you on.
Very possible. Just drop me a line.
Okay, will do. Hey, Stephen, what's the music?
Love Is All We Need by This Is the Good Fight.
Okay, that's what we're going to sing. And thanks for being with us once again, George. Thanks, Stephen. Till next time, live to see it.
Intended it to get this far, but you insisted. How could I resist it? Was so in love I couldn't stop these kids from moving. You're so contagious, it's so outrageous. I can't stop myself when I'm around you. It's the reason why I've been so down. Was exactly what I was afraid of. Love is all we need. Love is all we need. Love is all we need. I still remember exactly how you felt. It's unforgettable. It was incredible. Keep your ego down where it's supposed to be.